The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of the Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling, well, a foundational philosophical movement. Many people think it's quite abstract, maybe even obscure.
Right.
But our sources really argue it's one of the most practical skills you can actually learn for living today. We're diving into Chad Engelin's exploration of phenomenology, the skill of lived experience.
And I really appreciate that framing, the skill part, because Engelin is quite insistent. You know, this isn't just another head in the clouds theory.
Mm-hmm.
It's presented as a method, a way to pay attention, to really re-engage with the actual physical, sometimes messy world around us. It offers a crucial third way, he calls it.
A third way between
between those old philosophical extremes, you know,
yeah.
Like pure detached objectivity on one side and maybe paralyzing skepticism on the other. Phenomenology tries to carve out a different path.
Okay, so let's unpack that right away. Why is this skill, this method, so necessary today? Engelin's argument seems to be that we're fundamentally, well, lost in thought.
That's a great way to put it. We live surrounded, absolutely saturated by scientific abstractions, by data points, by other people's theories and models.
Yeah, like we might know the molecular structure of our lunch.
Exactly. But have we forgotten what it feels like to actually taste it, to experience the texture, the warmth? That's the gap he's pointing to.
That sense of alienation, then, is the modern issue he's tackling.
Precisely. And phenomenology is the method that kind of shouts, hold on, stop just looking at the reports, the charts, the theories for a second.
And do what instead?
Let's return to the things themselves. That's the famous call. It's almost an antidote, isn't it? To knowing the chemical formula for pine, but feeling totally disconnected from the experience of seeing a pine tree, maybe feeling its rough bark, or smelling the air under its branches.
Okay, so it's about getting back in touch with direct experience. Who's our guide for this re-engagement?
Our guide is Chad Engelin. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Dallas. And his specialty is, well, the heavy hitters in this field. Husserl, Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty.
The big names.
The big names, yeah. He has really deep scholarly roots in continental philosophy. But his real strength, I think, is taking this incredibly dense, sometimes jargon-filled material.
Which it definitely can be.
Oh, absolutely.
Huh?
And presenting it with, frankly, remarkable clarity.
And that clarity is probably why he's such a good guide for this topic, right? Because he spent decades teaching these pretty difficult concepts to undergraduates.
Exactly. He was required to figure out how to distill these profound, complex ideas into structures that are clear, that are pedagogical. So you get the depth of the thought, but without, hopefully, the confusing presentation that sometimes comes with it.
And what's his unique angle on it? Does he see it just as history of philosophy?
No, not at all. This is what I find really fascinating. He argues that phenomenology is vitally relevant now, not just for philosophy itself, for ethics or cognitive science.
But where else?
But also for really contemporary fields. Things like user experience design UX and even artificial intelligence.
Okay. How does philosophy from a century ago connect to UX design or AI?
Well, think about it. Any field that's grappling with what it means to be a conscious human being, whether you're designing an app people interact with, or trying to build some kind of artificial awareness.
Right.
You're wrestling with fundamental questions about human experience.
Mm.
And phenomenology tackled those questions head on. It offers a kind of philosophical toolkit for understanding consciousness itself, not just describing its mechanics or outputs.
Okay, let's dive into the book's core ideas then. What's the central thesis Engelin is putting forward?
At its heart, phenomenology is presented as a rigorous method. It's a way to investigate the fundamental structures of experience, the very structures that underlie all human knowledge, all meaning making.
So it's foundational.
Very foundational. The aim is to build a basis for understanding truth and meaning that manages to be both, let's say, scientifically rigorous, but also humanistically rich. That doesn't want to sacrifice one for the other.
And how does it achieve that? What's the key insight?
To get there, it first has to sort of dissolve that classic problem we all inherited, mainly from Descartes, right? This idea of, I have a mind locked inside this body, and there's a world outside. How on earth do they connect?
The mind-body problem.
Exactly. Phenomenology tries to dissolve that barrier.
Uh-huh.
And it does this by revealing that consciousness is fundamentally intentional.
Intentionality. Okay, that sounds like a key term. What does that mean in practice, not just intending to do something?
No, it's broader than that, much broader. It means consciousness is never just a blank slate. or an empty container, it's always directed towards something. It always has an object.
Can you give an example?
Sure, like to desire is always to desire something. To be anxious is always to be anxious about something specific, even if it's vague. Consciousness and the world aren't separate things that need bridging. They are co-given. They arise together from the start.
So if I feel bored, the boredom isn't just some random chemical thing happening in my brain.
According to phenomenology, no. It's boredom of this specific meeting or of that repetitive task. It always points you back, anchors you back into the world. It's relational.
I see. It forces you to look for the what or the about what of your inner state. Okay, so the book takes us on a journey then.
Yeah, a pretty clear one. It starts by sort of diagnosing this modern alienation we talked about.
Yeah.
Then it introduces this revolutionary idea of intentionality. Then crucially, it gives us the tools, the method to actually practice this new way of seeing. And then it expands that view to include our bodies, the lived body, and the shared social world. The whole goal, really, is to cultivate a disciplined practice of attention and description for the first-person perspective.
Okay, let's get into those tools and concepts. You mentioned Husserl's famous motto, to the things themselves. Let's start there. What does that call really mean?
It's a radical call, really. It means turning away from all the preconceived theories you might have, whether they're grand metaphysical speculations or even just settled scientific assumptions you take for granted.
Turn away from those.
And turn toward the phenomena, the appearances, exactly as they are given to you in your direct experience. Before you layer on interpretations or explanations, it's demanding a kind of intellectual honesty. Go back to the source.
And intentionality is how we access those things. You gave the example of perceiving a cube earlier. We only ever see a few sides at once, right?
Precisely. You never see all six sides of a physical cube simultaneously. You see maybe two or three if you're at a corner.
But we don't experience it as just seeing two or three disconnected flat surfaces floating in space.
Exactly. We experience a coherent whole cube, a solid object. And that is where the active meaning-giving role of consciousness comes in. According to phenomenology, our minds aren't just passively receiving sense data.
They're doing something with it.
They're actively synthesizing those partial views, those perspectives, into the unified experience of a solid cube that we trust is there, that we can walk around, that we could pick up. Consciousness is structuring the world as it appears to us.
Okay, so consciousness is active, it's structuring. If we want to study that structuring process itself without getting caught up in what it's structuring, we need the main tool you mentioned, the epoche.
That's right, the epicoche, often translated as bracketing or suspension.
How does that work? How do we actually do this bracketing? It sounds a bit abstract.
It is a mental posture more than anything.
Yeah.
The epicoche is the deliberate suspension of what Husserl called the natural attitude.
The natural attitude?
Yeah, that's just our everyday common sense, uncritical assumption that the world exists out there exactly as we perceive it, totally independent of our consciousness. We just assume it's there.
Okay. So bracketing means denying the world exists.
No, no, not at all. That's a common misunderstanding. You don't deny its existence. You simply temporarily set aside that belief in its independent existence. You put it in brackets.
Like hitting pause?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Or think of a scientist controlling variables in an experiment. They aren't denying the other variables exist. They're just holding them constant, neutralizing their influence for a moment to isolate the one thing they want to study. Here, you bracket the assumption about existence to isolate the structure of the experience itself. How does the world appear?
Okay, that distinction is important. It's a methodological step, not a metaphysical claim. So if the epoche is the mental tool, let's turn to what we experience through, our bodies. This brings us to Merleau-Ponty and the idea of the lived body.
Yes, this is a crucial move, pushing back hard against that mind-body dualism inherited from Descartes. The core idea is we don't just have a body. Like you might have a car. We are our body.
What does that mean, we are our body?
It means the lived body, le corps vécu, is the very center of our perceptual world.
Mm.
It's the vantage point from which we experience everything. And it's also the source of a huge amount of practical pre-reflective knowledge.
Pre-reflective, meaning stuff we know without thinking about it.
Exactly. Think about typing on a keyboard or riding a bike or playing a musical instrument. You're not consciously thinking, okay, now move left index finger to the F key. Your body just knows how.
Right, it's automatic almost.
That practical know-how is held in what phenomenologists call the body schema. It's a kind of implicit knowledge of, I can. My body knows how to navigate stairs, how to reach for that cup. It's the medium through which we grasp and interact with the world.
That makes a lot of intuitive sense. We're not just detached minds looking out through eye sockets. We are embodied subjects right there in the thick of things.
Precisely.
But if my embodied experience gives me my world, how does this framework account for the fact that we seem to share a world? How does Engelin bridge the gap between my lived experience and yours?
Ah, that's where the concept of the life world comes in. The Lebenswelt in Husserl's German.
The life world, okay.
The life world is the familiar, everyday, pre-theoretical world that we all inhabit together. It's a world of common sense, shared practices, language, cultural habits, unspoken social rules.
Like knowing how to stand in line. Or what a red light means.
Exactly. It's the whole background of taken for granted assumptions and skills that allow us to understand each other and coordinate our actions without constantly having to analyze everything from scratch. It's the bedrock of shared meaning.
And Engelin argues this life world is often forgotten.
Yes, particularly by science. The critique here is quite pointed. Scientific theories, which often claim ultimate objectivity, are actually abstractions derived from this messy, meaningful, intersubjective life world.
They don't replace it.
They can't replace it. Even the most dedicated scientist doing abstract calculations still has to live in the life world. They still need to use language, trust their perceptions, to read instruments, collaborate with colleagues using shared understandings. Science builds upon the life world. It doesn't float free from it.
That's a powerful point. Okay, so we have the lived body, the shared life world. How does time fit into this picture of experience?
Time is absolutely central. Phenomenology argues we don't experience time as a series of static, disconnected now points like beads on a string.
Right, that doesn't feel like how we experience it.
No, our consciousness is inherently temporal. It's constantly weaving time together. Husserl called this internal time consciousness.
Internal time consciousness. How does that work? How does it create, say, our sense of self over time?
Well, in every present moment, as you're experiencing something now, your consciousness is simultaneously doing two things related to time. It's retaining the immediate past.
Like the sound I just heard, or the one you just finished saying.
Exactly. That immediate just past lingers for a moment. It's held in the present awareness. That's retention. And at the same time, consciousness is anticipating the immediate future.
Like expecting the next word in your sentence. Or seeing the door I'm about to walk through.
Precisely. That's pretension.
Hmm.
So the present moment isn't an isolated point. It's this thick, dynamic flow that inherently includes the trailing edge of the past and the leading edge of the future.
And this constant weaving.
This constant integration of retention and pretension within the flow of consciousness is the basic structure that allows us to experience duration, melody, movement. And ultimately, to form a coherent narrative identity. A sense of ourselves as a continuous story unfolding through times, not just a jumble of disconnected moments.
Wow. Okay. So our very sense of self is tied to this temporal structure experience. Now, if time gives us our ongoing story, where does freedom come in? You mentioned Sartre earlier.
Yes. Sartre took these phenomenological structures, particularly the idea that consciousness is always reaching beyond what is towards what could be, that pretension, that directedness.
Right.
And he really emphasized this as the core of human freedom. Because we're not fixed objects, because our consciousness is always projecting possibilities, we are constantly, inescapably choosing what we will be, what meaning we will make.
Which led to his famous, rather dramatic claim.
That humans are condemned to be free.
Condemned? That sounds quite negative.
It's heavy, right? But it highlights what he saw as the inescapable burden, but also the dignity of this constant choice. We can't not choose. Even refusing to choose is a choice.
And how does this connect to ethics? You mentioned Levinas.
Levinas took this framework in a profoundly ethical direction. He argued that the fundamental experience isn't actually self-consciousness, but the encounter with the other, specifically the face-to-face encounter.
The face of another person.
Yes. For Levinas, seeing the vulnerability and the demand in the face of another person is the primordial ethical experience. It calls us into responsibility before we even fully understand ourselves. So for him, ethics actually precedes ontology or self-understanding. Your obligation to the other comes first. Okay, there's a lot there. If we try to synthesize these insights from Engelin's treatment, what are the main takeaways? What are the big messages?
I think there are three huge ones. First, and maybe most central, is the primacy of lived experience.
This is the pushback against just looking at data or abstract theories.
Exactly. It's a call to value and maybe even trust the depth and richness of your own direct engagement with reality. Your subjective first-person experience isn't just noise to be filtered out. It's the ultimate foundation, the court of final appeal for all knowledge, including scientific knowledge.
So why should you care? It encourages you to, well, trust your gut sometimes, or at least pay attention to your direct experience.
Pay serious attention to it, yes.
Yeah.
And maybe give it more weight compared to just abstract reports about reality.
Okay, first theme, primacy of lived experience. What's the second?
The second key theme is consciousness as active and world-constituting.
Not just a passive mirror reflecting the world. Definitely not. Through intentionality, consciousness is this active process. It's constantly interpreting, synthesizing, structuring the world as it appears to us. It's giving meaning.
What's the reflection there? What does that mean for us?
It means we're not just passive observers in a pre-made world. We actually collaborate in how our reality takes shape for us, which puts a certain responsibility on us, doesn't it, for the meaning we find or the meaning we fail to find.
We co-create our experienced reality.
Okay.
And the third thing.
The third is the importance of the intersubjective life world.
Right, that shared background understanding.
Yes. The point here is that meaning isn't just generated privately inside individual heads. It emerges through our interactions with others, through shared language, shared tools, shared cultural practices. It's fundamentally social and historical.
And the reflection. Why is understanding the life world important?
Well, if you really want to understand complex social issues or conflicts or even just how everyday cooperation works, you have to examine that shared, often invisible, taken for granted background. The life world is where the action is, so to speak.
Okay, those are three big themes: primacy of experience, active consciousness, and the shared life world. Now, these thinkers often coined memorable phrases. Fenelon likely highlights some key quotes.
Absolutely. These dense ideas often get distilled into powerful, almost aphoristic statements. They really stick with you.
Let's touch on a few. We've already mentioned the absolute core one, haven't we? Consciousness is always consciousness of something.
The bedrock. It's so simple, yet so revolutionary. It elegantly ties mind and world together from the start, dissolving that old problem by refusing to separate them in the first place.
And reflecting that move away from the disembodied mind of Descartes, there's the quote about the body.
Yes. The body is our general medium for having a world. That's often associated with Merleau-Ponty. It establishes the body not as an object we possess, but as the perceiving subject, the very condition for having any world appear to us at all.
Then there's the ethical challenge, summed up in Sartre's famous paradox. We are condemned to be free.
Yeah, it captures that sense of inescapable responsibility, the weight, but also maybe the dignity of knowing that we are constantly shaping ourselves and our world through our choices, whether we like it or not.
And finally, maybe one that sums up the practical, methodological core of the whole project.
I think that would be, we must learn again to look at the world. It sounds simple, but it's the fundamental mandate. Use this disciplined attention, this phenomenological method, to uncover the rich structures of meaning that are right there in our everyday experience, but often hidden by habit or theory.
Learn again to look. Okay, so these aren't just abstract philosophical points. Engelin emphasizes the practical applications. How does this skill actually help in real life? You mentioned self-understanding.
Yes, the epoche, that bracketing of assumptions, can function as a kind of powerful mental hygiene, as someone put it.
Mental hygiene? How so? Like dealing with difficult emotions.
Exactly. Take anxiety, for instance. Instead of just being swept away by the feeling or immediately reacting based on your usual story about why you're anxious,
right?
Phenomenology encourages you to pause, bracket the judgments and interpretations for a moment, and just describe how the anxiety is appearing to you. What are the specific bodily sensations? Where do you feel it? Does it have a direction? Is it focused on a specific object or situation in the world? What's its temporal quality? Is it about the past, the future?
So you dissect the experience itself rather than getting lost in the why.
Precisely. And this act of careful description from the first-person perspective can create a bit of distance. It can give you greater self-awareness and potentially more agency in how you respond rather than just reacting automatically.
That sounds a lot like some mindfulness techniques, actually.
There are definite overlaps, yes. Both involve paying close, non-judgmental attention to present experience. Phenomenology perhaps puts more emphasis on describing the structure of that experience and its inherent connection to the world.
Interesting. What about applications beyond self-help? You mentioned UX design.
Yes. In professional fields, this focus on lived experience is crucial. Think about designing anything humans interact with, software, physical products, services. Good UX design isn't just about efficiency or task completion rates.
It's about how it feels to use it.
Exactly. Designers influenced by phenomenology try to understand the user's lived journey. What are the actual feel of the interaction like? What are the user's expectations, frustrations, moments of flow as they experience them? It's about designing for the human subject, not just for the data points.
And in healthcare too, perhaps. Yeah. Empathy.
Absolutely. Or in any relationship, really. It's about setting aside your own theories or assumptions about the other person for a moment and trying to genuinely understand their lived world. Asking, implicitly or explicitly, what is it like for you? That's a fundamentally phenomenological move towards empathy.
And you briefly mentioned AI earlier. How does phenomenology challenge standard approaches there?
Well, it pushes back against a purely computational view of intelligence.
Right.
By insisting that true understanding, true meaning, and maybe even true intelligence are inseparable from being an embodied agent, actively engaged in a practical shared life world.
Right.
It suggests that an algorithm processing abstract data about tables, for instance, is doing something fundamentally different from a human who experiences a table as a place to gather, as something solid to lean on, as part of a meaningful social situation. It raises deep questions about whether disembodied computation can ever achieve genuine human-like understanding.
That's a fascinating challenge. Okay, as we wrap up our deep dive into Ingelin's take on phenomenology, what are your final takeaways? What surprised you or stood out most?
You know, what really struck me, reading Ingelin's accessible approach, is reinforcing that this isn't just some historical curiosity or an abstract theory to be debated by academics.
Hmm.
It really is presented as a transformative skill, something you can actively practice.
A way of being in the world.
Exactly, a way of paying attention. And it feels like it provides really necessary tools to resist some of the abstraction, the fragmentation, maybe the alienation that can come with our modern day saturated lives. It's a call back to a more attentive, grounded way of living.
For me, the final takeaway is that powerful realization, which seems obvious once stated but often isn't, that the so-called objective world that science describes so well, it doesn't just float there on its own. It's utterly dependent on and built upon the much richer, messier, shared subjective foundation of the life world. Our lived experience isn't secondary, it's primary. And that makes this philosophical movement feel, well, vitally relevant. It gives us tools to understand meaning, value, and the human condition in a way that pure data never can.
Well said.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.